On our show coming up, we have some commentary on the fallout from the tariffs, the Trump tariffs. I'll introduce those one at a time as they come up. And then we're going to hear a piece by Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. And finally, we'll have a little encouraging words from Cornel West. And here is a web commentary by Bering Jung, is the name, and the title is China Targets American Farms.
Everyone expected China to hit back, but no one thought they'd go straight for America's farms. The U.S. just raised tariffs on Chinese goods. Washington expected retaliation. But instead of targeting tech, manufacturing, or finance, China went after agriculture. Why does that matter? Because agriculture isn't just another industry. It's one of America's biggest economic weapons. The U.S. exports more than $150 billion in agricultural goods every year. China has been one of its biggest customers. And now, that door is closing fast. This isn't just about money. It's about pressure. China isn't just hitting the U.S. economy. It's hitting the heart of rural America. Why? Because that's where Trump's biggest support base is. If farmers feel the pain, the political pressure shifts. And that's exactly what China wants. And here's the real question. Is this just the first move? Or is China setting the stage for an all-out trade war that the U.S. can't afford to win? If there's one thing that makes American agriculture powerful, it's exports. And China just put that entire system at risk. Here's why this is a big deal. The U.S. doesn't just feed its own people, it feeds the world. More than 20% of all American-grown crops and meat are sold internationally. And China? One of the biggest buyers, until now. China knows exactly where to hit. Soybeans? The U.S. sends tens of millions of tons to China every year. Corn? Beef? Pork? All major U.S. exports, now on the chopping block. If those sales disappear, farmers don't just lose profits, they lose their entire market.
And that was web commentary by Bering Jung. Coming up next, we have Professor Richard Wolff talking about the economy of the U.S. and China.
Economically, the game is over. The Chinese, if not already a wealthier economic unit than we are, which they probably are, will be within a few years, very few, like by the end of this decade, if not already. So economically, they are now our equal. But remember, they're our equal, they're going up, we're going down. We're equal, but the trajectory is unmistakable across the board. Right? And so politically, comes right after that. If you're that powerful economically, if you're the place that the whole world goes to cut a deal because you get a better deal than you can get from Washington or London, which is now most of the time the case, that's why if you look at the biggest harbor being built in Africa, it's being built by the Chinese. If you look at the new railroads going across parts of Latin America, it's built by the Chinese. You know, on and on and on. You know, the Panama Canal, why does he want to take it? Well, the United States is the number one country using the Panama Canal. China's number two. China has built all these buildings to handle their shipping. You know, it's everywhere, and once you start looking, you see it everywhere. But militarily, there's none of that. Americans have to understand, even if you don't agree with me, try to understand how the rest of the world looks at it. The United States maintains 750 military bases around the world. China doesn't have any.
That was Professor Richard Wolff. Next, we have some web commentary about the lumber tariff by Doug Weaver.
Why should we be buying? buying lumber from other countries.
Because that's where the trees are. These different colors are different kind of trees, and what you need to know is that this is the kind of trees that we like to build houses out of. We can also use these ones, but they're not as good. And as you can see, Canada's just trees galore. So I guess we could cut down our national forests to make 2x4s. But unfortunately, we would actually run out pretty quick. Then we'd have to wait another decade for those trees to grow again so we can harvest them again. And another interesting thing about trees is that the farther north they grow, the slower they grow. And the slower they grow, the harder the wood is, which makes it better. The wood is also better the longer you let the trees grow before you cut them, and these are all uncut forests. When it comes down to it, Canada's wood is just longer, harder, thicker, and uncut. And they are eager to let us have it. We should just let their wood come all over America. Because in reality, we just don't have enough forests in the United States to keep up with the demand for construction. In fact, this is a post that I made in 2017. Remember back in April when Trump got mad about Canadian lumber replacing American lumber? Well, it turns out that a 30% duty on Canadian goods doesn't mean that America produces more lumber. The lumber we used to get from Canada, we are now getting from Europe and Asia, and it costs a lot more. Notably, lumber imports from Russia have increased by over 40%. This lumber comes from forced labor camps in Siberia, where Russia has purchased workers from the North Korean government. So let's break this down. We hurt our relationship with Canada so that we can support the oppression of North Koreans for the benefit of Russia and North Korea's governments, all so that Americans can pay more for soft lumber, and it will cost Americans wanting to build a house 20% more than it would have cost last year. How does that put America first? You know how we have a housing shortage and construction costs have gotten outrageous since 2017? The houses being built now are not as sturdy as houses that were being built 10 years ago, and they cost more. Asking why we get lumber from Canada is like asking why we get coffee from Ethiopia, or why we get pineapples from South America. That's just where they come from.
And that was Doug Weaver. Next, we have Medea Benjamin talking about the arms cutoff to Ukraine.
So Trump has called for a pause in weapons to Ukraine, and Democrats have gone crazy, and many of the Republican war hawks have gone crazy and said, how can we do this? We have to keep sending weapons. We can't abandon our ally. Well, you know what? It might be that Zelensky wants to keep fighting an unwinnable war that is only killing more and more soldiers from both sides, but the majority of people in Ukraine do not. If you look at the opinion polls, it shows that the majority want a quick negotiated solution to this war. The majority are willing to concede territory if it means ending this war. And that's what we have to do. Trump is trying to push Zelensky to the negotiating table, and that is a good thing. I also hear all these Democrats saying, it's in our security interest to keep sending weapons to our ally in Ukraine. In our security interest? Really? It's in our security interest to send more than $180 billion of our tax dollars that have already gone to Ukraine? I don't think so. I can think of a lot better use for $180 billion to help people who are having a difficult time in this country, paying for their groceries, paying for their rent, paying for their health care. So I think it is in our national security interest to get both sides to the negotiating table and end this war. Yes, Russia should be condemned for starting it. It should never have invaded. But now we're at a point 3 years later where we must find a negotiated solution. And this is one of the few things where I support what Trump is doing.
And that was Medea Benjamin. Coming up, we have State Rep Jermaine Johnson of South Carolina talking to oppose the DEI in South Carolina, and he was successful in doing that.
You don't like being called racist in here. You hate when we use the word racist. You hate being attacked. You hate when we bring up race and everything. But then when we have an opportunity to show that we're not racist, you let me down every time. Every time. And I sit here and we talk about our families, we talk about our kids, we go on trips together, and then we talk about not funding state, not using our state dollars to go to white supremacy programs, and then we table it. You want to talk about some stuff? Let's talk about how they just took almost $7 million from the College of Charleston because they want to help black kids. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about all the amendments that are in the state budget right now to defund all the black programs that are going across the state. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about AP African American Studies that was banned from this state. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the attacks that you got going on people who don't look like you. Let's talk about it. Why do we continuously do this to our kids? Why? What is it that you're doing? What are you showing your kids? That public funds can go to white supremacy programs? We just had an issue at USC where all those kids felt scared. Matter of fact, we just had the Patriot Front on our steps last week. What are we doing here? Tell me what we're doing. Don't try to explain to me, well, I thought it was this, or it's that. Nah, Jermaine, we want to see equality. We give you an opportunity every single time. And here we go again. I was in the back. I was ready to go just like y'all are. But here we go. Every single time you get an opportunity to show us something different, you show us who you are.
That was South Carolina State Rep. Jermaine Johnson. Coming up next, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine.
So, Francesca, thank you so much for sitting with me today. It's been, for me, a long time coming, wanting to interview you and sit with you finally in person. So, thank you. Grateful for this opportunity. And I'm hoping we can cover just a few things in general. And, of course, we can go into the details of those things. The ongoing genocide, of course, in Gaza, how your response has been to it, and what you see as Palestinian self-determination versus, say, charity or just humanitarian aid alone. I'm wondering if we can start off maybe by looking at how did your life change as a rapporteur after October 7th?
My life has definitely changed after October 7, 2023. It was already busy and with a lingering sense of pain due to natural compassion that I think most of us carry as human beings, and the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory for Palestinians was very heavy. So this has intensified because the pain by overexposure to what has happened in Gaza and then in the West Bank and what has been suffered by everyone, by the Palestinians, the Israelis, but what has been done heavily to the Palestinians from Israelis has been life-changing. And of course, this has changed who I am as a special rapporteur. Sometimes I feel less lightful or less... I feel like hardened. Mm-hmm. But how... I mean, it has... From a strictly professional point of view, this past months have been much busier than everything else I've ever done or experienced in my life. For 1 year, I've been almost on call to partners, colleagues, victims, and anyone who wanted to report to me. I've had this crazy no-door policy, basically, for 1 year. And then I had to take some distance and also create some space. But otherwise, I've been really very much on call also for journalists and others who needed to understand what was going on, because there has been such a manipulation of the narrative that has made me feel more responsible, even more responsible to put the facts and their legal qualifications at the end of the at the center of the debate. And I've been simply more busy also because I've traveled much more. All of a sudden I experience something that is quite unprecedented for country mandate holders. I'm invited by state authorities or civil society, youth movements, Palestine solidarity movements, to go and give lectures or to talk to government officials, to animate the national debate, which is somewhat a challenge in and of itself. And also it puts me at strain, I mean, in a difficult situation with government officials. But at the same time, so many governments are responsible for enabling what has happened to to the Palestinians, yeah, I take the challenge.
Yes. And since October 7th, you wrote at least two reports on the genocide. And of course, before that, before October 7th, you were also writing, publishing. I'm just wondering if you can comment on the extent to which you see, taken together, your writings having an impact.
Well, look, in retrospect, it all makes sense, in the sense that I recently reread my Unchallenging report, the report I wrote about living conditions of children under occupation. And my third report, and then my second and first report, respectively, on detention, on arbitrary deprivation of liberty and self-determination. And when you read this report, it all makes sense. I mean, it was a tragedy. What has happened to Gaza, what is happening to Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, but all Palestinians, in fact, under Israeli rule, this is a tragedy foretold, because Israel's ambition to realize sovereignty for the Jewish people only, or for a majority of Jewish people, has to happen at the expense of the non-Jewish populations, the Palestinians, Muslim and Christians. And so, there is a natural escalation of repressive methods against the people as a whole, the people as a group, not seen as as individuals, but as trapped in an identity, trapped by identity politics. And so I often say this past 16 months I've become an unwilling chronicler of a genocide. But yeah, I mean, look, if self-determination is the right to exist of a people as such, the denial of the right to exist of a people as such is genocidal. And so the ultimate enemy of genocide is the revendication of the right of self-determination. So it goes back to square zero, where I started my work and reflection, Palestinians in relation to a law of self-determination in 2022. Mm-hmm.
And do you remember the exact day that you were able to make the legal determination that a genocide is occurring? And how that might be, I just want to add one thing, how that might be different from what's called ethnic cleansing?
Yeah. Look, what has happened to me in the past 60 months, it's something that is the culmination of a process. Since I worked on my main research project before becoming a special rapporteur, that led me to write Palestinian Refugees and International Law, which I published in 2020 with Oxford University Press, I did realize that we couldn't have a compartmentalized approach to international law. We couldn't we couldn't separate international humanitarian law from international humanitarian law. When it comes to Palestinian refugees who have lived across generations of lack of international, systematic, structural lack of state protection, I realized how the real protection of human beings is in the interplay of international law. And this is also what I see now as part of the decolonization of legal studies, seeing the value, the strength of international law from a people-centered perspective in the way international law can protect human beings. This is a general feeling that has accompanied me. And of course, this has not been always present in terms of self-awareness, but this is what has happened. So to go back to your question, I've seen through my own work on, for example, on self-determination in 2022, on arbitrary deprivation of liberty and the protection of children, this mantra of international law is either to protect individuals or is not really human rights oriented, becoming an imperative for scrutinizing the conduct of the international, of Israel and international community in general toward Palestine and the Palestinians. With this in mind, when did I came to realize that genocide was ongoing, when I understood what genocide was? Because, you know, I mean, genocide is quite, or used to be, quite a niche topic in international law. So everyone who studies international law, international human rights law, international criminal law, studies genocide. But then somewhat it stays there. For example, throughout my career, I didn't have really the chance to deepen my knowledge of the ICJ jurisprudence on the cases of genocide until Palestine. So I remember vividly, as you asked me for the day, I remember vividly that it was around mid-October, Ras Segal had already written about what was happening in Gaza as a textbook case of genocide. Ras is an incredibly principled human being, not just an incredible scholar, because already in February 2023, as I was writing my detention report, you had got in touch with me and say, you're the special rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory, why are you not using the genocide framework? And I was like, is he crazy? Why would I? Because for me, I mean, genocide was Rwanda, genocide was the Holocaust of the Jews, genocide was what had been happening to the in Srebrenica. And this is when I was, so, and in mid-October, early mid-October, I wrote a press release, I wrote a statement denouncing the fact that Israel was clearly taking an opportunity to advance its ethnic cleansing of in the occupied Palestinian territory. And I will go back to this, but I understood what genocide was. I was forced to understand what genocide was when I had this discussion with other special rapporteurs. I remember I was in New York in preparation of the presentation of my report on the situation of children in the occupied Palestinian territory, so October 2023. And other colleagues, other special rapporteurs were saying, "It, look at the statements of Israeli leaders. These are genocidal." And I was saying, yeah, but they've always said it. I said, but this is wrong. I mean, they shouldn't be saying that. And plus, they have declared a full closure, over the closure, no food, no water, no electricity, no fuel. This is one of, and they with a determination to punish the Palestinian people, to target the Palestinian people, this might lead to creating the conditions of life that would be physical and biological destruction for Palestinians, thousands, if not tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, all the more while heavy bombing was ongoing. And I was skeptical, so some colleagues said, you don't understand what genocide is, with all due respect, go and read what genocide is. And this was a trigger for me. All of a sudden, how come? I mean, of course, there might be areas of law or that we do not know. But on Palestine, you know, I have this thing, I know a lot. How come other people see things that I'm not seeing? And then it really didn't take me that long because I started reading William Shabbas or Ras Segal or Dirk Moses, Martin Shaw. But what probably was the most eye-opening of all, and this is besides legal scholar, is Raphael Lemkin, the scholar who's coined the term genocide. And I mean, the way he talks about the destruction of a people are something that it's a process, not an act, and something that happens and might happen in stages, but there are clearly some early warnings to understand what the destruction, when the destruction of a people is an aim, a political aim, this was when I, all made sense. The denial of self-determination, the mass incarceration, the mass segregation, the separation, the fragmentation was already the curtailing of vital connections for the people. All of a sudden, the people appeared to me as a body. And that was the target of genocide. And then I realized that there was still, and with this I will close the circle, I was saying we need to understand international law holistically. We tend to think of, oh, is it self-determination or is apartheid? Hey, all of these stems from the same evil, which is the denial of the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people, which is the right to exist as a people in a given land. And it happens through various crimes, including apartheid, which is systematic segregation, domination of a group over another, with the intent to maintain the domination, and it entails the commission of inhumane acts in the process. And genocide, as the destruction of the group, can be a means to an end. I mean, it's not given in international criminal law that genocide must be the end. You want to kill or destroy the group to destroy the group. The motive is not relevant. And in this case, I'm 100% sure that the motive is ethnic cleansing. And not because I speculate. It's because Israeli leaders and the people at large, many in the Israeli society, are saying that the Palestinians must go. The Palestinians do not belong here. We need to annex. It will be ours from the river to the sea. And it goes on and on. It has been ongoing for 16 months relentlessly, but it's not new. This is something that was already ingrained in not necessarily outspoken Israeli political mindset, but it was there. The Alon plan from 1967 to expand Israeli control over what remains of historical Palestine. And so ethnic cleansing ethnic cleansing is, unlike genocide and apartheid, is not a crime. But ethnic cleansing is is the policy to render a given land ethnically homogeneous by eliminating other ethnicities through administrative procedures, segregation, or criminal acts, forced displacement, killing. So ethnic cleansing, as it was established by a UN commission leading to the consideration of the ICJ cases of genocide in former Yugoslavia, can consist of genocidal acts.
Yes.
And this is the case here.
Mm-hmm. I feel the need to ask, do you feel that the international community, notwithstanding at all the widespread support for Palestine, especially among young people throughout the world, mm-hmm. do you feel that the international community has largely failed Palestine? Yes,
the international community, in terms of member states, in terms of United Nations, have largely failed the Palestinian people. And this is not even something that dates back to the past 16 months. Again, as a tragedy foretold, this is something that the dismemberment of the Palestinian homeland and consequently subsequently the Palestinian people is something that has been happening also through and thanks to the impunity that has been granted to Israel to continue to displace Palestinians and taking their land dunum after dunum, inch by inch, home by home, segregating communities, building exclusionary roads, creating prison-like encirclement for the Palestinians, creating conditions of life mixed existence near survival. This has happened over 57 years in the little that remained of Palestine, in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, which for the past 30 years has been sort of discussed under the premise of an international consensus that recognized the occupied Palestinian territory as the land over which the Palestinians had an exclusive right to self-determination in the form of statehood, which doesn't mean that no Jewish people could have lived there. But had they lived there, they would have been Palestinian citizens and perhaps rented or purchased instead of stealing Palestinian property. So the demise of Palestine has happened and has gone hand in hand with their relentless reciting the mantra of the two-state solutions. How much hypocrisy. I mean, member states saying, oh, the only way forward is the two-state solutions, and then they wouldn't even recognize. I mean, states like Canada or Australia or Italy or the United States, everyone investing on the Palestinian Authority, right? Everyone talking about the state that we will be, even perfecting the functions and the paraphernalia of a state, while the primary element to have a state, the land, was disappearing under Palestinians' feet.
Absolutely. You made a really interesting observation, or a statement in a previous interview not too long ago, I think it was with the Rights Forum, about how you would like to see one day an investigation into Western media's coverage of the genocide. And I'm so curious to know, did you mean like a legal kind of investigation or journalistic kind of investigation in terms of its complicity or normalizing this genocide?
Well, there could be many, right. Many options. Yes. There should be many options, yes. In fact. Because accountability can be pursued in the most traditional ways through state authorities' investigations, being through ombudsman, quasi-judicial bodies, or the police itself, prosecutors, etc. I think that there are. I've come across cases where there was the fabrications that have been spread by the Israeli state, Israeli army, or others very close to the. To the government have been repeated consciously by the by certain media, the dehumanizing language used against the Palestinians, not just dehumanizing language toward the Palestinians. This is something that has become structural. It is so constant and subliminal that is also part of our understanding of reality. Probably not you and me, but people who are not expert would understand that Palestinians have brought havoc upon themselves because of October 7. And this is such a fallacy. But yes, so there is a responsibility of the media, like there is a responsibility of most Western governments, in fact, who have fostered the dehumanization of the Palestinians, which has been instrumental to enable and the current genocide. Because it's true that many people have protested, but the majority, looking at the numbers, the majority of the people has not moved a finger. This is the reality. It's not about, even 1 million out of 6 or 60 mobilizing. It's very little. There is a genocide. They have killed 18,000 children. I mean, and we, in my own country, we have been honoring the victims of October 7, commemorating them for months and continues. And I'm not saying this is wrong. This is totally normal. This is what compassion is. I'm just appalled that I've not seen an inch of that compassion for the 18,000 children that have been killed in Palestine. Like, I think that Daniel Levy, the way he put it recently at the UN Security Council, is the most telling of all. He said, of course, we owe 1 minute of silence to the two Bibas children who were taken hostages and killed with their mother in Israel, in Gaza. And we also owe 1 minute of silence to each of the 18,000 Palestinian children who have been killed in Gaza, which will make 300 hours and 2 minutes of silence. Yeah, this is the reality. How come we are so desensitized toward the Palestinians? Because we are also part of our cultures, are also prone to their dehumanizations. Again, as an Italian, I'm telling you, I feel awful in describing this, because we have done it already. And there is another genocide that happened under our eyes, probably not televised as this one. But we knew one century ago, up to 90 years ago, 80 years ago, we knew what had happened, what was happening to the Jewish people and the Roma and Sinti. The Jewish people were part of our societies. And still, all of a sudden, no more doctors, no more professors, no more neighbors. All of a sudden, they were completely dehumanized. They were a security threat. They were to be expelled. And you see, we eventually, under political pressure and exposed to heavy political propaganda, human beings behave like herds. We don't think. Our compassion stops. And this is something that, for me, it's unacceptable. I really despise people who have a racial bias, and they have also the audacity of accusing others of being biased and partial. Right. Yeah, no, it's so dystopic.
Yes, you know, it's interesting you mention that, because I'm wondering, well, you already touch on it, if you have any insights into what this kind of complacency reveals about humankind. I almost feel naive, because before October 7th, I would never have imagined that the world would remain this complicit.
Me neither.
That it would get to this, and as you're saying, like, the ratio would be so small. I mean, do you think, like, philosophically, what that reveals about people? I mean,
that we're racist.
That, yes.
We're very racist.
We have not progressed as much as we think.
No, but at the same time, I think that member states and international relations are still dominated by racism. And this is the litmus test. I mean, Gaza is the litmus test to expose the extent of this racial bias. But I think that collectively we are doing better. So this is why I say people shouldn't feel discouraged, because I know that it's very dark right now. But I see the sparkles of light. I see the sparkles of light because there are cracks on the wall. And if there are cracks on the wall and we see the light, it means that we need to keep on pushing to bring the wall down and not pause and not sit idle in the face of this darkness.
Yes, of course. I'm wondering if you feel that because of this genocide, your office of the Special Rapporteur will have permanently changed in ways that were never considered before or people could never anticipate, because there is this ongoing genocide. So it will require the next rapporteur and the next rapporteur after that to undertake new sets of responsibilities, maybe to be more activist in their approach, anything like that.
I don't know, because, you know, fundamentally, message-wise, or I don't think that I've been that different from my predecessors. I've learned a lot from them. And in terms of framework, use of the legal framework and analysis, I think I've really operated in continuity with them. Of course, the circumstances have changed. I'm 100% sure that had Michael Link or John Dugard or Richard Falk found themselves in this situation, they would have documented exactly what I have documented and probably gone to the same, arrived at the same conditions, at the same conclusions. What is probably different is the pace of this, of the engagement. I have renounced, I've put aside my work, the teachings, the various teachings I had. And again, I felt this way. Again, I did it because of the genocide. In the context of the genocide, it was unavoidable. And of course, I want to resume. I want to resume my work, but it's incredible with all what's happening, to be able to cut a line. Sometimes I would just like to see, not to deal with it anymore. I'm also tired and I would like not to look at this horror day in and day out. I would like to pretend like others are doing, that there are days without the genocide. Sometimes I would also like to forget the Palestinians, but I don't do. I don't do, not because I don't have the power, but I can't, because something inside me tells me, no, you are the special rapporteur. You are not any human being in this one. You have a responsibility. And if it were you on the other side, if it were your children, if it were your husband, if it were yourself in this situation, yes, you would like people to speak out. And there are so many people who are speaking out, who are putting themselves in the front line, facing repression, beating, harsh punishment, even arrest and detention, suspension from work. Yeah, I have to be with them, and this is probably where I've got more active. I don't think activist is the right term, but yeah, surely I've been out there, because now the human rights movement needs support from all corners. But I see other special rapporteurs doing the same. We are very principled and human rights committed individuals. So like other academics or people from other professions and walks in life, you cannot stay silent in the face of a genocide.
No. It's like you said, I think that is an appropriate word, dystopian, because all these persons are being punished for doing the right thing. I mean, you're trying to stop a genocide and you're being fired or arrested or thrown in jail. I mean, for me, it forces me to question everything I was raised to believe, that if you do the right thing in life, you will somehow, I don't know, be honored or rewarded or something, but not punished. And this is what's happening, is all these people of conscience are being punished.
Yeah, but I also think that this is a reflex that people in the West have. Because for the past 80 years, which means for three generations plus, we have enjoyed a relative calm. In the sense, we have had no wars in our territory. Yes, there have been proxy wars during the Cold War, but mainly fought by the US and Soviet Union through or in other countries. We've never been faced with this for the past 80 years. Yes, there was the war in former Yugoslavia. Now there has been the war in Ukraine. And somewhat I see that over the past 20 years we have been desensitized, and also diplomacy has lost its function. But going back to how we react, how do we see the response of the system? Here, we are challenging a system. Yes. The protection of Israel by Western states is due to the fact that Israel is part and parcel of the Western family, which is Europe and the settler colonies, the US, Canada, New Zealand and Australia. Israel is no different. Yes, it's in the Middle East, but no different than New Zealand and Australia being in the Asian continent, in the Asia Pacific. So I do believe that we need to remind ourselves that defending human rights is an unavoidable choice to improve the living reality we are in at every challenge. It has not been easy to, it has not been easy to abolish slavery. It has not been easy for women to enjoy fundamental freedoms and equal rights. Think of the right to vote. Well, rights are not there yet. But the right to vote, how many people have been crushed? How many lives have been crushed? How many women and others who stood with them have been put in jail or beaten or raped or killed in their fight for equal rights and equal freedoms? We are at that turn. We have forgotten. We have become too lazy in our comfort in thinking that the government will give us everything. No, the governments now more than ever are showing the limits. And it's fine if we stay quiet, we buy our smartphones, we go on holiday once a year, if we have money, we can vote. Yes. But we cannot protest. I'm not comfortable with that. For me, freedom of expression is the most fundamental right that a society has and must preserve. Yes. So, which has so many declinations and implications.
Yes.
And this is at risk right now.
Well, I almost sometimes think, I'm not sure how you feel about this, but sometimes I think of Israel as like emblematic of the West, or the West writ large, in the way it treats people, you know, take things that you want without asking, destroy all you want to get all you want. Don't be concerned about the humanity of others. I feel like
I'm often critical of the West, but I don't think this is the case. I think this is really capitalism. Which is not unique to the West, of course. It has rooted first and foremost in Western liberal democracies, but it's not unique to us. And it's true, and this is very true in the US, most probably. I mean, as a European, I recognize, I see that individualism, but it's so not my culture as a Southern Italian. I mean, I feel much closer to, I mean, I've been living in Tunisia for almost 4 years now, and I've been living in Palestine for 3 years and in other places in the Arab region. Although there are many differences between my own country and here and Arab countries, I feel much closer to this culture than Northern Europe in many respects, for the good and bad. And there are so many things that I admire and I adore of Northern Europe. This culture of compassion and sharing is also very Westerner, because in the West there is also Greek, there is Southern France, there is Spain, there is Portugal. And also the people in the Balkans, we're very warm, but we're very, very caring and very communal, which doesn't mean that. So there are so many things in the West that are wonderful. Even this culture of hugging. Hugging is a healing. And again, I think that there are so many beautiful things in Western culture, and also the way the legacy of the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, and there is something that has trickled down into our culture. I don't want to discard everything that the West is and has, but of course, there is the dark past, the dark colonial past that has not only affected 500 years of international relations, so our relations with whatever was the world that we have colonized. Yes. But where does it come from? It's Christianity. It's white Christian mentality that has are spread. And this is why I often point to patriarchy, and people do not necessarily understand that. But it's a patriarchal society that through the Middle Age has developed and become so structurally dominant in our realities. And the struggles against patriarchy have been human rights struggle, like women's emancipation in my own country during the 60s and 70s, or other forms of liberation have been somewhat a challenge to that structure, which is patriarchy, which is capitalist, and now it's getting more and more weaponized.
I'm so glad that you mentioned Italy, your culture, because when I was preparing for this interview, I couldn't help but be curious, just, you know, sharing your culture as someone of Italian descent. Whether your culture has played, in your view, some role in being a principled person, not just with respect to Palestine, but more broadly, with respect to concern for humanity, for these issues of human rights that you're talking about, and so forth.
I'm sure it has, and it's not just the family I grew up in or the country I grew up in. It's really the sense, the communal life, this sense of taking care of one another, which is very ingrained in my upbringing. I mean, wherever I go, I mean, I say I have very strong roots in south of Italy. This is a place I still call home somewhat, but I've been traveling now, and I've been living across many countries for the past 22 years. And wherever I go, I put my roots somewhat. So I also move, and there is always a sense of community and a family of friends and others that develop. It's really this warmth has been part of my upbringing. And it makes me probably more genuine, less defensive to the other. And I find this somewhat disarming for certain people. It's disarming because it's brutally honest. And So it's interesting because I was visiting my family, my mom, recently, and I had dinner with friends, and we were discussing about my life in this public sphere that I've never really looked forward to. I mean, you know, I'm someone who doesn't even take pictures with her children because I really don't like pictures, and all of a sudden wherever I go, can I take a picture? I have to respond to people who really want to take pictures with me. And I say, what? And at the same time, I say, if this managed to inspire them or make them committed or make them feel, you know, to remember this moment of oxygen and take it forward, why not? But so, and so I was discussing how I am, and she was saying, but when I see you, the way you are, you're really that person. I mean, with us, in your private sphere, you are that person. When you say, I'm so Southern Italian, you are so Southern Italian from here, from Irpinia, this place which is, you know, it's the end of the Apennino Mountains, and it's, so the community is close to the outside world, but so communal, and very strong and matter of fact, and it's a farmer's culture, so a strong attachment to the land, a strong attachment to the elements. In fact, I'm sure that this is part of who I am also as a persona, and it has been part of my persona even before being a special rapporteur.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for this engaging discussion, Francesca. I'm just wondering, before we wrap things up, if there's any final thoughts or observations at all that you'd like to share. Yes.
Let me think.
Yes.
Yes, two things. And one is very much about international law. People shouldn't be over-optimistic about international law, but they shouldn't be pessimistic either. International law is a tool, and we are lucky to have it because we have human rights, thanks to other people who have been fighting in order to have those rights codified. And now for us, it should be easier to litigate and to vindicate those rights, because for many of us, especially in the West, those rights are part of our constitutional life and constitutional public life. So we should be less self-defeating and more engaging in wondering, okay, now this is my starting point. Human rights are my protection, are my armor. How am I going to use it in order to make my contribution to humanity? Because taking care of someone else who's being vilified, abused, violated is part of feeling human, is part of feeling that compassion means feeling with, feeling the sorrow of. And also, the other thing that is connected to this is that sometimes I feel that people expect change to drop from the sky. Uh-uh. We are the change. If we don't manage to change ourselves, how we can change the environment? If we cannot, and again, and this is why I go back to the rights discourse. I see so many people being silenced and not reacting. And say, but your silence is normalizing abuse. So when I think of myself, I've always stood up for others. I've never been silent. I've been more vocal in defending others than myself. But I've also understood that I had to take care of my rights. It's something sort of innate in me, connatural to who I am as a human being before becoming a lawyer. So I wish this sense of discipline and this sense of collective self could be switched on in people. Because we are part of a bigger struggle. It's beyond Palestine. It's about us as well. And the way I see the space for fundamental freedoms shrinking and shrinking in our own societies, in civilized Europe, mm-hmm. is frightening and should raise alarm among all of us. So yeah, I hope that people will be more sensitive and more responsive and proactive to this.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Francesca. I'm very grateful for this.
Thank you for talking to me.
Yes, my pleasure, my honor. Thank you.
And that was Francesca Albanese. And finally, we have Cornel West with some good advice.
And so anytime you talk about love, you're talking about two things that most people don't want to talk about. First thing you're talking about is courage. Courage is that enabling virtue that makes all the other virtues possible. And if you're a coward, you'll never know what love is. Because you never know what vulnerability is. You never know what intimacy is. You never know what opening yourself is.